Welcome to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph. Dive into the live courtroom drama as we bring you unfiltered audio from one of the most riveting trials of the year. Accused of multiple marital murders, Randolph's fate unfolds before us. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. This is Dark Vows.
We are back on the record at C250966, State Nevada versus Thomas Randolph. May the record reflect Mr. Randolph is present with his attorneys, deputy district attorneys on behalf of the state. Do both parties plead into the presence of our jury?
Yes, sir.
All right. Defense, are you prepared to give your closing argument?
Yes, sir.
Whenever you're ready, Mr. Randolph.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, first of all, I'd like to thank you on behalf of the defense for your time. I know this is difficult. I realize you come and go and you have to be told when to be here, and I could see you paid very careful attention on behalf of the defense. Thank you very much for that. State of Nevada versus Thomas Randolph. This is a murder case. And this murder case is about murder. It's also about perspective. Perspective. So now I'm going to tell you very quickly where I'm going. On May 8th, 2008, Thomas Randolph and Sharon went to the Santa Fe Casino to enjoy a celebration of Mother's Day. Little did they know that the person that they had helped, Sharon, put boots on that murderer's feet. Thomas Randolph had helped him. They had been kind to him. And that guy got in that house. And when Sharon Randolph and Thomas Randolph came home, because they didn't go to the movie, they ran into a burglar. Michael Miller shot Sharon Randolph in the back of the head. And when Thomas Randolph was in that bedroom, because he was spooked, he got a gun and he did what any husband would do. He shot and killed Michael Miller, defending his home, defending his wife, defending his own self. That's what happened. It's just that simple. And as we go along, I'm going to get in much more detail, but recognize it is that simple. That's what Michael Miller did to Sharon Randolph. A contact wound. There he is. A murderer and a thief. And a burglar. That's a murderer. There's not a single person in law enforcement, there's not a single person that would say he is anything different than a first-degree murderer. This was Dayton. This was Thomas Randolph coming home, hand in hand with Sharon. This mastermind has decided, because that's what they're saying, right? He's a mastermind. So he decided, hey, when I leave the Santa Fe, I'll want to make sure I'm holding hands, because that looks like we love each other. Really? So he knew the police were going to go and get the Santa Fe video and see a loving couple, because that's what it shows. They're holding hands. They went to the charcoal room, and then they decided to go home. I have some complaints on behalf of the defense. And a lot of them come from the opening argument that was made by the state of Nevada. The state of Nevada told you things they could not prove and were false and wrong. The prosecutor told you that the scene, this was his first clip, problem number one, the scene tells a very different story. And before I go into much more detail about it, the prosecutor told you there's not a single bullet strike in that hallway. Not one. He was absolutely wrong. And I'll show you it went farther than the prosecutor just telling you there was no bullet strike in that hallway. You actually call a witness, and we're going to hear about it. Okay? Scene tells a different story. Not a single bullet strike in the hallway. The prosecutor actually put up a slide that says that, an opening argument. Let's hear it.
Mueller, in Tri-Analyst process, that scene, there is not a single bullet strike in the hallway.
Let's see if that's accurate. Because see, what I would argue is when the state of Nevada gets up and tells you something, it's like a contract. Remember something from when we picked you. Who has the burden of proof? State of Nevada. We remember those sort of things we did where we said we don't have to say anything, we don't have to do anything. They have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would ask you, if we weren't doing our job, look at what would have been told to you. Just listen to this.
All right, I want to talk to you then about this defect that you identified on the wall. Do you remember using the word defect when you talked to Mr. Hammer?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember what you called that defect when you wrote your report? Page 3.
I've got a bullet strike, yes.
You identified it as a bullet strike in the hallway when you were documenting in your report, right?
Yes.
Bigger than 3 millimeters, right?
Yes.
Took a photo of that, right?
Yes.
Okay. Nothing about that apparent bullet strike can be collected and preserved for purposes of testing later, right?
Right, correct.
Okay. But you can take a picture of it.
Yes.
And you saw that, yes?
Yes.
So you would appear to be a bullet strike, right?
Yes.
In that hallway, yes?
Yes.
And you photographed it, right?
Yes.
And when the word defect was used on direct examination, that's his word, and you agreed with it, right?
Bullet strike, I called the same thing.
Okay, well, in your report, you didn't say defect, did you?
15 years ago, I did not.
What did you call it 15 years ago?
15 years ago, I called it a apparent bullet strike.
Okay, and 15 years ago was a report related to the date you were there, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
I probably called the same thing today.
Bullet strike?
Yes.
Okay.
Prosecutor told you there was no bullet strike. He's had this case. He knows the evidence. And then he put a witness up, and what did he do? Oh, defect. Oh, it's defect. Because he knew it. He couldn't have a bullet strike in there. He's nervous about that bullet strike. Remember that? We showed you it. And I really want you to think, we don't have any burden. We don't have to help that guy. We can just sit there. And if Mr. Tomczyk doesn't do that, everybody thinks it's a little defect. Well, it was a bullet strike. Why would the prosecutor tell you that? See, because it's the state's perspective, isn't it? They want you to believe he didn't want Sharon to live. Want you to believe he didn't want her to have medical attention. Now, there are some real concerns about this. Real concerns, because the prosecutor presented statements, and what we hear in the 911 call is quite clear. You hear Thomas Randolph screaming and crying. And there's a point, you know, some part of it sounds so, and if you envision it, and you think that your wife has been shot, and you roll her over, and you see that image, what would a person do but scream? Your wife is gone. She's in terrible shape. And he did what a normal human would do. He screamed. And when I hear the state of Nevada complain, he didn't do this right, he didn't do that right, he didn't do this right. Can you imagine what a reasonable person would feel in that condition? How horrible it would be. How difficult it would be. I don't know how to do this. They blame him for saying, should I go open the door? Do you know what he was saying? Maybe if I go open the door, they can come and help her. We want you to understand our side. And we don't have a burden of proof. We don't have to prove anything. We have to show doubt. We don't even have to show that. If you see doubt that's reasonable, you're required to find Mr. Randolph not guilty. He wanted her to have medical aid. He was the only one who did it. I want you to do something. Listen to the 911 call. There's that silence. After you hear the clearing of the house, there's a silence. And it goes on. And the reason the silence is important, because you could hear it the first time, like, why is he talking about the silence? Tommy is outside. And he's wondering, because I brought it out in the statement. Remember how in the beginning they were saying that he was complaining about law enforcement not showing up for 20 or 30 minutes? That's not what he was complaining about. He was complaining that 911, that medical, didn't go in. He could see they're not going in. They didn't go in to help her. The only person who gave her aid was him. He tried in vain, because you can see there's nothing that could be done because of what Michael Miller had done to his wife. You know, the suggestion that Michael Miller was anything other than a murderer is offensive. The evidence says they're wrong. Because what they did, what the prosecution did, is they told you a bunch of things in opening argument that we'll go through that were inaccurate. Here's a big one. Seemed like a relatively innocuous witness. Amy Corn got up on the witness stand. She says, 911 lady. And there were questions about compressions. Mr. Hamner asked, did you hear? Did she get chest compressions? No. Let's listen. Let's listen to this.
I'm assuming in preparation for your testimony, you had an opportunity to talk to the prosecutors in this case, right?
Correct.
And Mr. Hamner, the guy that just asked you questions, you've actually spoken to him a few times, right?
Correct.
And he told you, I'm going to ask you these questions, right?
Correct.
Like, how many times in your career has someone done in X, Y, Z, right? And he said, told you, I'm going to ask you, at this point on this particular tape, do you hear someone giving chest compressions, right?
Correct.
Okay. And so you knew that question was coming and you knew what your answer was going to be, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Can you explain to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury what a chest compression sounds like?
No, I cannot.
Because a chest compression doesn't have a sound, right?
Right.
Why was that done? Why were you told that? Why was that in a pre-trial where the lady got up? And I would suggest she became a pawn, because when Mr. Tomchek was asking her questions, you could see she was almost embarrassed. There was a meeting, and I did say I was going to say that, and I don't know what a chest compression sounds like. Why would they do that? Well, you know why they're doing it, right? Because if she'll say there's no chest compressions, then that's what you'll believe. Do you see that? You'll believe there's no chest compressions, so that makes him a liar. He's a liar because you didn't give her chest compressions. Why? Because that was an orchestrated attack upon a defendant.
Objection.
Yes. You are the finders of fact. You decide what happened in front of you. You can't see for yourself. I hope you looked at that carefully and ask yourself, what did that mean? Why was it done? It was done for the same reason that there was a defect in the hallway and not a bullet strike. The medical timeline, we put that in there because it's important. The phone call, 911, comes at 20:44:58. The CAD report indicates Thomas Randolph, person reporting, requested medical advice. 3 minutes into that call, that's what's happening, or that's on the CAD report. Operator indicates AMR advised of delay. Reason that is important is because that tells you they weren't going in. Now you understand why firefighters and paramedics may be kept out. It's a very frightening situation. But from Thomas Randolph's point of view, he'd hoped that his wife could get help. And that's what he complained about that night. I'd suggest to you that's quite interesting that he complained, you people didn't go in there. They request medical at 2021. The media arrives at 2154. Fire Department 9 AMR are present. Look at that. The truth. Tommy fought to save her life. He cried and pleaded. He begged for help. And medical didn't come. I would suggest it would have been better. You can see the wound as the medical examiner testified. Dr. Gavin, she said, she would have dropped right there. This, again, is a prosecutor telling you in opening argument. Defendant waited 12 minutes after Sharon was shot to call 911 and get help. Now, this is this timeline. And this timeline has absolutely been destroyed. The state of Nevada wanted you to believe that. They told you that. They promised you that. They guaranteed it like a contract that it was 12 minutes that Mr. Randolph waited. You know why they're saying that? Why do you think? Oh, well, he's staging this whole thing. Okay, well, that's not accurate, because the prosecutor actually told you conservatively. See, remember, he does a timeline. Look at Funny's gas station. Takes 3 to 4 minutes to get home. So what time does he get home? 8:30. What time does he call 911? 8:45. I know it's 8:44:54, but the prosecutor tells you 8:45. See, because he's coming up with this big, long gap, right? Let's look at the truth. Let's look at what they knew, and let's look at what really happened. Mr. Bartlett said that he was on the phone. He was on the phone, and there's the prosecutor, 8:30, conservatively. That's a quote. And it's not true. And we'll get to this. The prosecutor wanted you to believe it had to be 8:30. So one of the things they did is they play a video for you. You may remember this if we could watch. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to take about a minute to watch. But what I'm really going to be demonstrating is if you could see.
He was driving away right now, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And can you watch it and let us know when you cannot see it any further? Because it's going to turn, right?
Yes.
Towards Rancho, right?
Correct.
Can you still see it?
Yes. Well, what happened?
Okay. Did you hear Detective Mogg say, what happened? Because Detective Mogg even knew. Why is the car still going? But they cut it out. See, because that's what they wanted you to do from that time. And they said repeatedly, the state did, 8:26, he leaves. No, let's watch the rest of the video, because even Detective Mogg saying, no. It goes, and then it goes to the red light, and you can see that he waits at the red light until 27. It's not important, really. It doesn't really matter whether it's 27, 28, because we know from Bartlett what the timeline is. But let's show you the video we had to put in. We had to show you a video. And here you go.
Okay, so I want to keep watching after the state's
The state's video turned off. Do you recall that?
I do.
And you could still see the vehicle at the time the state's video cut off, right?
Yes.
Okay. So he's driving away, correct?
That's correct.
It's 8:26:21, correct?
Yes.
I want you to tell me at the very time you can no longer see that vehicle. It's come to a stop at the stop
light. So right now it looks like you stopped in the turn bank.
Okay.
And you can see the arrow on the vehicle. Detective Moggin put it on there for us.
Okay, what was the time? 8:27?
27:23:24.
Why did they cut it off? Why? Because, see, they're trying to prove up a timeline. They need that 11 or 12 minutes. There should be no doubt that the prosecution is desperately trying to get you 11 or 12 minutes when it's absolutely wrong. Because what does Mr. Bartlett say? And I'm sorry, because during this trial, sometimes I gave you seconds. I thought it was important you knew the time, rather than... Again, there's a finder's effect. What do you think of that? That man is on trial. This is a very serious trial. Why are things like that being done? You be the judge. Mr. Bartlett came up on the witness stand, and I asked him, because I knew what the answer was. When you were on the phone to your friend, did you see something? Yes. I saw something. I saw the neighbors come back. And I saw the garage door open. I saw them go in, and I saw the garage door close. When did that happen? When I was on the phone with my friend. So they get the phone records, and what does it show? He starts that phone call at 8:33:36. So what can we make from that logically? That if he starts a phone call at 8:33:36 and he's on that phone and he sees the Randolph car come, they couldn't be at home at 8:30. You see, because now they're missing their 11 or 12 minutes. It's starting to tick away. Why did they think it was so important, 11 or 12 minutes? They thought it was vital to tell you that. And yet now, they've got a bigger problem. Because even at the beginning, remember he said it was sort of the beginning of the conversation. Let's take that as true. Let's just say it was 8:34. 8:34 that he sees this. Now think about it. If it's 8:34, 8:35, 8:36, the car comes, a garage door has to open. Do the mental math. A garage door has to open. He's seeing this. Sharon had to walk in. Tommy can't run her over, so he has to let his wife go into the house. And then he slowly came in. He said it was hard for him to get out. The garage door closes, and what did I ask Mr. Bartlett? How long after the garage door closes do you hear something? 25 to 30 seconds. Do the math. He also tells us something very interesting, Mr. Bartlett. He says that he's been around, that's what he said, and when he heard blasting, he told his friend, I heard blasting, and he got off the phone. What time did he get off the phone? 270 seconds later, from 8:33:36. So you're looking at past 8:38 when those gunshots happened. Well, now you got a problem. Because we know if it's 8:38 and at 8:44, that's 6 minutes and about 50 seconds. What happened to their 11 or 12 minutes? It got destroyed. Why did they think it was that important to tell you that? Because it was necessary for them to prove their case. We don't have a burden of proof. They have to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't have to make these arguments. I don't need somebody like Mr. Tomchak with all his talent to stand up here and show a witness and prove to you. Doubt everywhere. And again, when you see that, I ask you, what was the purpose of it? Why did they do it? What was the necessity to do that? Was that fair to Thomas Randolph? Was it fair? I suggest it was not. And so, there's a slide on Mark Bartlett. 8:33:36, he's on the phone, gets off the phone at 8:38 because he heard the shots. That's proof positive. That's how the state's case fell apart right in front of you. Let's look at what really happened. Concentrate on what really happened. The truth behind it. Who's Mike Miller? Who is that human? Well, I'll tell you one thing. I know one thing. This man, you know what? Before I move any farther, one thing I did when we picked you, I owned something. Talked about being obnoxious, politically correct, incorrect. Just no filter. And there's no way I'm taking it back. Because who's he? Some of the things that were said, just obnoxious. He has no filter. There were things that were said that just shouldn't be said. Sometimes he's rude. And I would suggest he's born that way. He's always been that way. And he's that way as he sits next to me. But there is no instruction that Judge Jones gave, not one, that says you convict a human being of murder because you don't like it, because you think he's offensive, because he says things he shouldn't say. We don't convict people of murder for that. But who's this guy? Who's old Mike Miller? Well, we know. State, they admit that he's done it. They do say Mike Miller murdered Sharon. He's a thief. He's a murderer. And how do we know he's a thief? Because remember, he had that driver's license, didn't he? Michael Hoag's driver's license. Michael Hoag's stuff. He had it in his pocket. So we called Michael Hoag, didn't we? And you saw Mr. Hoag was. He's a criminal. He has. But he still had a right to his stuff. And if he's, I don't know, strung out or falling asleep on the Greyhound, he still had a right to his stuff. How did it get in his wallet? Even the detective said, well, maybe it, maybe he took his wallet. He actually said that. And it makes me wonder why Detective O'Kelly, 60 witnesses, but you don't interview Mr. Hoag? But Mr. Hoag talked about, didn't he, two detectives, two people coming to see him and asking these questions years ago. What was that about? I would suggest the state of Nevada doesn't like that information, because what it does is it shows you something. If this mastermind over here, he's the director, what did he also do? Oh, well, when they find you, I'm going to need you to be looking like a thief. So why don't you put somebody's fake or somebody's identification in your pocket? We also know he's a thief, too, because Corey Thompson had a cell phone. And Detective O'Kelly told us, without, I asked him, don't tell us what he said, it's hearsay. Was there any connection between Corey Thompson? No. He stole that, too. What about that cosmetic? Did I say that right? Cosmetic? Or was it costume? That cosmetic costume jewelry ring he had in that left pocket. Now, I don't know. People's finances.
But I would suggest there are a lot of people that would be very proud to get that ring. So I don't think the state of Nevada has a right to tell you something that is obviously false. I don't know, maybe you think that ring is worth nothing. That ring was valuable. It looks like gold. It looks like diamonds. And it looked like something that a lot of ladies could be proud of. A lot of husbands, boyfriends, anybody, lovers, could be proud to give to somebody and say, that's theirs. And to have police say, oh, that's costume. It's cosmetic. And they won't back off from it. Well, did you appraise it? No. Do you hear the way, oh, it's a gold medalist looking thing with some clear glass kind of things. That's not fair because they know what Michael Miller's done. I'd suggest to you that what happened in that house, Michael Miller was packing everything up. I would suggest you use your ordinary common sense with that cocaine man that he saw. Maybe Mr. Talker over there is like, oh, I just wanted this ring. It's very valuable. Maybe sharing to show pride in it. And he saw it that night. He put it in that in my pocket. And he loaded up his stuff. Being the burglar he was. One thing I just can't wrap my mind around is the state of Nevada keeps saying, why would he do it on that day? Why would he do it? Why would he do it on that day? They were gone for a week beforehand. They're going to be gone for a week after. Why would he do it that day? It seems so obvious. If he's house-sitting, and has house-sitted in the past. He has a key. Who's going to be the most obvious suspect when he's supposed to be house-sitting or away? What did you hear without contradiction in this trial? That Thomas Randolph had taken money out that day and that he missed the turnoff and that Michael Miller knew he had a lot of money. Michael Miller's not a well-planned-out human being. He does things with opportunity. Somebody was sleeping, I got that. Somebody's phone, I got that. That was the day he could be in and out. Burglary only takes 5-10 minutes. Anybody who knows that should know that. It only takes 5-10 minutes, especially when you know where the things are. And he's perfectly fine. He's probably got another 15 minutes in there because they're going to watch the movie. But they came home and they interrupted a burglar. And this is what happened. Let's look at what the evidence is. You see, that shoe is very important too, that Reebok shoe. It came out of a bag. Because why on earth Michael Miller is doing, you know, got his change of clothes, don't know if the girlfriend's out back, don't know if the girl, somebody's a getaway driver. And how do we know that? Because of the great interview that was done with the girlfriend. You remember that? I asked Technical Kylie, did you talk to the girlfriend? No. What kind of car did she have? Huh? Really? This is his girlfriend. Remember, she's going away with him to Florida or California. He's coming into money. And what did he say? I'm done with that guy. That's what he told you. But you look at that evidence up there, and you can see a lot of different stuff. You see the jewelry. What else do you see also? We'll get more to that little dent there, okay? The dent. Do you remember? There's another one. Prosecution asked the witness, are there any dents on the refrigerator? Now, I think the prosecutor's going to say, well, I meant this side or that side. Yes, there's a dent. Let me help you answer the question. There's the dent. Well, look at it. Are there any dents in that? No, there are no dents. And then we showed it to him. Yes, there are. Again, if we're not doing our jobs, which again, what's our job? Nothing. We get to sit over there and do nothing. They have the burden of proof. They have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. And then they say things like that. And if we're not paying attention, people may be back there deliberating, man, there's no dents on the fridge. There's no dents. Yes. There are. Why are we having to do this? Why are we having to look so hard to show you what's really happening? Is this really fair? Is this really what the state of Nevada should be doing to
telling you there's no deaths when there is, telling you 8:30 when it's not accurate. No chest compressions. Michael Miller's clothing. There is something very confusing about this mask. The mask so obviously came off when Thomas Randolph said he bumped into him. He couldn't have said it more. And if you actually watch the walkthrough, watch Detective O'Kelly keep moving away from where Thomas Randolph actually says. Thomas Randolph says multiple times, I bumped into him. Something happened with his mask. Something happened. He even says, I think it did something to his eyesight or something. He just got it caught. If you look at the mask, he just got knocked off, so he took it off. When I asked Detective O'Kelly, why would he take off the mask? That was what was asked of him. What would be the purpose? Oh, now he's killed the person, so he doesn't have to worry about identification. I want you to think that through. I wore a mask in a house because I'm going to kill this lady, and I'm going to shoot her in the head, and then, okay, well, now I can take it off. She can't identify me. What were they going to come, you know, like, who shot you? That made no sense. He's a burglar. He has to worry that when he leaves, there are cameras, there are people who could see him. He can get over a backyard, down the street, change clothes. It's obvious. You don't. Why is he wearing gloves? You know why he's wearing gloves. He wears gloves because although he's been in that house, he knows his hands shouldn't be on a safe. He knows he's ransacking and that there's jewelry boxes. He can't have your fingerprints on those. So he wears gloves. Simple as that. There's his left pocket. There's that pretty ring. Cosmetic. Costume. There's Mr. Hogue. There's Mr. Miller's wallet, maybe. Mr. Hogue's license, card. Michael Miller's a thief. Why are all the facts saying Miller was a thief? He's got the ring in his pocket. He's got jewelry in the bag. He's got masks, gloves. And look at that bag of jewelry. He was getting out of there. They made a big deal about there are no shots in the hat. It doesn't make any sense. There's no shots in his shoes. Why is he wearing those cowboy boots that Sharon gave him? Because maybe he's worried about footprints in there too. And this will show that it's not me. But who knows what's going through that guy's head? You know, you're talking, when you talk about the mind of Michael Miller, you're talking about somebody who's a bad human. Because I would suggest that, this is just my argument, there's an instruction saying use your ordinary common sense. If I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. This is what I'd suggest. That violent behavior and crime are associated with...
Cancel approach.
You use your ordinary common sense, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. This man had cocaine in his system. You decide for yourself what that does to you. You decide for yourself. A lot of you have lived for a lengthy period of time. I would suggest to you that, well, let me say it this way. I think it was Detective O'Kelly who testified it is a plight on our society, didn't he? That's what he said about cocaine. He said that, I asked him. It was a plight on society. And that's exactly right. This man had used cocaine. This man had a reason to run because he was going to go with his girlfriend. And we know that for a number of different reasons. Look at the jewelry, and you see it scattered around. So apparently, I guess what they're suggesting is that Thomas Randolph put that there to stage it. And then again, he's so clever, he also, let me stage this correctly, and pull a few pieces out and the shoe out. It doesn't make sense. It's a frenzied scene. And the frenzy is something very, very important in this scene. Whose DNA is on those bags? Michael Miller. Now, Thomas Randolph also touched those bags. DNA, Michael Miller's. That's not cosmetic. Those coins may very well be valuable. I would argue you look at them carefully. If you can blow them up, you look at them carefully. They may be gold or silver. What do I know? But I know not to call it cosmetic without an appraiser. Inside the bags. Look at that. Before I go to this slide, I want to talk to you about something. I really want you to think carefully about what I'm going to say. If this is a plant, assume it is, assume for what I'm going to say now, that they're right. This is a plant that he has made up. Okay? Michael Miller shoots Sharon right in the back of the head in this plant. Just drops. She didn't see it coming. It's like a hit. Right? Why, if Michael Miller then takes off his mask, oh, high five, got the job done. Now what do I need to do? Make it look like Joe? Yeah, go on your way. Good job, Michael. As soon as insurance comes in, I get you the check. And Michael Miller walks away. And Thomas Randolph says, yes, he already did that in round number one. And comes up behind him and shoots him in the back of the head when the police come. He's like, oh yeah, this thing happened. And then Michael Miller ran right by me and I shot him. But that's not what happens. Do you see my point? What happened was frenzied. The shooting of Michael Miller is frenzied. If he was double-crossing, if Tommy was double-crossing Michael Miller, there shouldn't have been a frenzied attack. It would have been easy for Thomas Randolph to do the same thing, shoot him in the back of the head. It would have been so simple. Or just shoot him right in the chest. But what happens instead? You have a person running around. That shot through the elbow is frenzied. The shot's in the head. It's all over him. Because it wasn't double-crossing. Because it's exactly what Thomas Randolph said. And, you know, if you look at that crime scene diagram, it's really important. Look at it carefully. Because I tried to point out, you see, when Tommy came in, he sees Sharon, he realizes something's wrong, so he pops into that room. That's what he said. He said it all along. But once he goes in that room, you see, Miller couldn't see him. And that's why Miller had just committed a crime. Miller had just committed murder. Miller threw that gun down. Why would he throw that gun down? Because it's a murder weapon now. He just meant to steal it. And he couldn't see Thomas Randolph. So that's why Thomas Randolph explains that Miller's coming down and they sort of bump into each other. There's another thing I really want you to concentrate on. I really want you to think about. Maybe it's gone by, or maybe I just looked at this case too focused. Why, if this is a setup, did Thomas Randolph go get the .22 and take it away and throw it away? Why would he do that? It's a setup, right? He tells Miller, you shoot my wife with a .38, right? Shoot my wife with a .38. And then I'm going to double cross you with a 9mm. Why wouldn't he take the .38? Why did he get a .22? And then he appears to think that's the gun. He even says, I got it and I threw it in there by the garbage can. Why would he do that? Why would he just not get the .38? It makes no sense. He killed my wife with a .38. But he gets it wrong. He calls it, he gets it with a 22. Because he doesn't know. These are all indications. He has no idea. Detective O'Kelly tells you that the Millers are missing gloves. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Millers. Billy Miller was, you know, he was agitated. And, but the Millers said something very important. They said in their first interview, within hours, and by the way, he wasn't missing for 3 days. Vita Miller said, you know, I just saw him the day before. Billy's sitting right there. I understand Billy is angered. He's irritated with me. But they say something important. The police say, hey, you don't have a ski mask with like some holes in the eyes. And they both say, oh yeah, we'd be missing it. Billy Miller's like, ah, I got one of those. And Vita says something very important. They say, they actually use the term, Mrs. Miller, have you seen a mask like that? Yes. When was the last time you saw it? December 2007. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, when did Michael Miller move in that house? Christmas Eve. All of a sudden, they lost themselves a ski mask. I wonder what he was doing with that. And they were missing a pair of cotton gloves. Now, Billy Miller got upset about it. Prove it, he told me. So I had Detective Kelly say, did he say it? Yes, he said it. They were missing gloves. Gloves and a ski mask. What a coincidence. Have you realized what a coincidence this mask is? Now, who was excluded from the mask? The mastermind over here. The mastermind over here who supposedly threw it down, his DNA isn't on it. He was excluded.
I don't recall specifically what the DNA said. So, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you can remember the DNA evidence as you remember it to be from the DNA analyst who testified. I didn't know what those criteria numbers. I don't remember which ones they were.
You're listening to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph. There's more raw courtroom drama ahead as we bring you unfiltered audio from trial. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a minute. More Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph, next.